The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, this is Dennis O'Hare, and before we start this edition of The Political Breakfast, just wanted to remind you that as news about COVID-19 continues to unfold across Georgia, WABE is taking an unprecedented step. We're postponing our spring fund drive, and we're doing it so we can continue to bring you critical news with context and thoughtful analysis through features like The Political Breakfast. But the financial backing we get from our community is vital right now. So please remember, it's your support that keeps us going. Please make a donation if you can at wabe.org/donate. And thank you. While everyone holds out hope that an experimental drug tested here in Atlanta might help COVID-19 patients, Governor Brian Kemp is conducting a trial of his own as he lifts more restrictions on businesses in the state. Meanwhile, schools and students and parents are trying to get some idea of what the coming school year will be like, and there are still plenty of questions about whether there's enough good information out there to make any of these decisions. Well, we're glad you decided to spend some time with us on The Political Breakfast. Hope you are safe and well. And again, we're joining you from three different locations. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a political strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, welcome back. Hope you're well.
We're doing all right.
Happy Friday, Dennis.
Gentlemen, Governor Kemp decided to let his stay-at-home order expire at week's end, opening up more of the state while retaining some restrictions. He did this, Brian, as polling from the University of Georgia showed that roughly three-quarters of registered Georgia voters supported the stay-at-home order. 62% opposed his decision a week ago to let some businesses reopen. And also in the face of some conditions that haven't changed. This virus is a mass killer. We don't have a vaccine. There's no treatment yet, although the prospects for remdesivir are encouraging. And the one thing we know that does work, right now anyway, is the very thing the governor is loosening, social distancing. This is a huge gamble for him, isn't it?
I would disagree that the governor has loosened restrictions on social distancing. And every communication that I've seen from him, he has reiterated the need that even though you have these new freedoms to go about your business, unlike we've had the last few weeks, that you still need to be responsible, that you've got to make good decisions. You need to wear a mask and gloves and avoid groups of more than 10 people. If you can work from home, do work from home. If you can shelter in place, do that. So I don't know that he's really loosened any of these restrictions. The mandates on us for common sense remain. And I don't care so much about the snapshot polling on whether people agree with his new orders. I don't think it matters in the long run. What matters in the long run is how this works. If we have a spike in cases, if we see a stress on our hospital system, if we have a run on ventilators, those type scenarios, then there's going to be serious blowback for the governor politically. And you may see people nationally continue to pile on him. But the polling today won't matter at all if what he is doing and what he is predicting comes true, that we don't see a spike, that we continue to flatten the curve, that the data we see coming in continues to be positive. And hopefully, God, please, I pray, say that this new drug hope comes true, that we have something that's a good treatment, because we desperately need to get back to work. And 30 million unemployed Americans is unsustainable. And the damage long term, I think, could be even greater than the damage of the virus.
Theron, some state Democratic leaders have gone after the governor with full-throated criticism over the last few weeks, but others are being a little more cautious, at least publicly. They're being a little more quiet. I'm guessing that's in case, as Brian alluded to, that there might not be a spike in cases with the lifting of restrictions. How careful do Democrats have to be here?
I think Democrats are being extremely cautious, but they have the right to disagree and express their reasoning for their disagreement. You're right. We've seen people criticize the governor nationally on a Democratic side, but we've also had some Republicans in the state sort of disagree initially with the governor's decision. I think what's interesting, though, Dennis, is that when I look at people like Mayor John Ernst in Brookhaven, where you see him and Michael Thurman, the DeKalb County CEO, sort of say, okay, listen, the governor's made their decision. Let's start putting in processes in place to sort of particularly deal with restaurants. And what Mayor Ernst did in Brookhaven, let me be fully disclosed, I do represent the city of Brookhaven as a state lobbyist. He's saying, hey, okay, the governor's already put this sort of beginning stages in the process of restaurants being able to operate again within a sort of square footage and decide their restaurant. They're the only city in the state of Georgia to say, okay, we will sort of go a step further and allow restaurants in Brookhaven, if they choose to, with existing square footage that their landlord or their lease operator allow them to use, to actually let people choose if they want to eat outside. And so you do see a confluence of Democrats sort of saying, hey, we still think it's too soon. But you do see other Democrats like Mayor John Ernst in Brookhaven who are basically saying, hey, we want to move forward and begin the process of reopening the businesses. Last thing I'll say is this really quickly. At the end of the day, it's going to be all about the data. The governor has made a political decision now to sort of double down on his efforts to begin to reopen Georgia. And I do think that you've seen much more communicative strategy coming out of his office who are trying to talk to more people. And that was one of the things that the criticism came from. No one really knew that he was going to make this sort of reopening process announcement. And so I think at the end of the day, yes, he'll be judged by a lot of different things, but people are going to pay very, very close attention to the data that he had at the time when he was making these decisions, and the data that will be presented in the future.
Which begs the question real quickly for both of you. Did he have enough reliable data to make that decision?
He's going to have to answer that question. And I think he's going to answer it this week and continue to make sure that he update the people of Georgia.
You know, one tricky thing about this current situation is everybody seems to be working off a different set of data. I don't know that our data is completely reliable. I think a lot of the decisions that have been made, not just by Governor Kemp, but across the country and by the president, have been based on gut, based on a weighing of factors that choose between two bad options. And given that we don't have everything at our fingertips, they've just had to make decisions and move us forward. And I think that's what you've seen him do. That said, he'll still pay a price if he took a decision that turned out wrongly. But we need to also remember to praise him if he turned out to be right.
You sort of see that the data lag. We saw data this week that came out from 2 weeks ago that we had 100 people die from COVID. Now, it kind of was a sticker shock when you first read it because most folks was like, oh my God, we had 100 people die within the last 48 hours. To piggyback on what Brian is saying, listen, this really just boils down to two things. One, which data can we trust and which data is the governor operating on? Because there's clear conflicts of what the federal guidelines are putting in place and the federal medical experts are saying versus what Dr. Toomey is saying here in Georgia. And so when this is all said and done, I keep wanting to say this. Brian Kemp's decision to do what he did is going to be solely based on politics, but also is going to be based on what was done with the data. And let's not also forget that there's been some reports about the lag in the data that we've been getting in Georgia. And there's also some concerns about the inconsistency of the data. And so, again, I just think that it's what the politicians who are making these political and business decisions and safety decisions for us as Georgia, how much can we trust in that data? And then more importantly, what's going to be the data models that we use going forward to ensure that we don't see sort of a second outbreak?
Brian, on that point, the governor has said the data are encouraging. He has cited data, especially concerning hospital capacity and intensive care beds, which appear to be enough at the moment. But if you lift restrictions and if cases spike, doesn't that remove the thing that's allowed the capacity to stay at a stable rate? And it could overwhelm that very capacity.
That will be the test by which Brian Kemp is graded. If that happens, then his theory was incorrect. If we maintain the current level of infection, new cases, new deaths, et cetera, he'll be proven right by history. So only time will tell. But one thing that Brian Kemp has continually said that I think gets left out because the national media narrative, and it's odd that the national media has focused on us the way that they have. If you look at some other states, they've done the exact same thing. Colorado's new loosening of restrictions very much mirrors what Governor Kemp has done. But you don't see headlines about how stupid Governor Polis of Colorado is, even perhaps because he's a liberal Democrat. And
well, and Governor Polis wasn't singled out by the president either.
Exactly.
No, he wasn't. And that's something maybe the president should revisit, that what Brian Kemp has done is not that far out of line with what some others are already doing. But he'll be judged, nevertheless, and Governor Polis in Colorado will be judged by how this turns out.
Brian, the president, as you mentioned, said twice he wasn't happy with Governor Kemp. After that, the governor went out of his way to praise the president, to say there's no rift there. And just over a week after the president went after the governor, the president is letting the guidelines expire, the federal guidelines expire, and talking about how governors are making the decisions. Yet another pivot, it seems, and without a single nod to Brian Kemp in the process.
Yeah. You know, I did an interview with the Washington Post last weekend about the president speaking out against Governor Kemp. And I said in there that there's a chance that Brian Kemp's going to be proven correct, that this is going to go off without a hitch. And I said in that interview that if Brian Kemp is proven right, the first person to praise him is going to be President Trump. And there's a good chance that he's going to make Trump a convert on the issue. Now, the rhetoric from the president since he said that he was very unhappy with Governor Kemp has changed dramatically. I don't know how you can objectively look at what he has said and see how there's a lot of daylight between him and Governor Kemp.
But he hasn't come back and said, you know, Governor Kemp might have been right there. He's had plenty of chances to. He hasn't done it.
No, that's not really his style to say I may have misspoke. I think what he'll do is potentially begin to just change how he addresses the Georgia situation if it comes up again. I do think I would highly doubt that you'll see him come out and say he's very unhappy with Brian Kemp based on his loosening of restrictions again.
Theron, is there a lesson for Governor Kemp there? Because he was at the CDC with the president a few weeks ago, standing within a few feet of him when the president went after Washington's Governor Inslee. It would seem that maybe the governor could have picked up a hint there that, you know, this is how the president can go after a governor publicly.
I think the lesson learned for Governor Kemp is before you get on another call with President Trump to discuss anything, have your team already draft up two responses. One that's going to be very proactive, and you release how the call went before the president has an opportunity to go on national TV and throw you under the bus. Or the second thing is have a statement prepared that you still release proactively, praising the president for one positive or two positive things that he said on the call. This was a clear indication. I said this before, Dennis. Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, is not going to go that far that soon if he had no type of assurance or consistent communication with the White House to have some type of green light to say, hey, it's okay. And to respond to Brian, to your question that you asked Brian, the reason that you saw Governor Kemp get attacked by President Trump is because it has got more criticism than the governor of Colorado, is because President Trump went after him. And let's not also forget, since Brian Kemp won the governorship, Stacey Abrams and a lot of different organizations have basically been on the attack to claim that this election was stolen. They've sort of tried to paint Governor Kemp as the bad guy nationally. And so the press has done a spectacular job of trying to say, okay, let's get the Atlanta mayor, the Augusta mayor, the Brookhaven mayor, the Albany mayor, Savannah mayor. And oh yeah, by the way, we're going to get Stacey Abrams, who ran against him in 2018, to say things about, you know, how they disagree with what he decided to do. I think that you're going to see now that if Governor Kemp is right, then I do think you'll see him use that leverage to try to get the president to help him with something. We still need federal funding. We still need to have that good working relationship with the White House. But I think that there was definitely a lesson learned by Governor Kemp that you can't trust this president because he will do whatever he needs to do to promote his agenda.
Theron, you went where I was about to go, which is the funding. Georgia not only has a short-term budget crisis, just like every other state now, as the legislature gets ready to get back together, but it could blow through its rainy day fund, even though it has been built up over the years. Brian, I'll actually shift this to you. Are state GOP leaders staying away from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's suggestion that states that are struggling be allowed to file for bankruptcy and get instead of getting help in a possible next phase of a federal relief package?
I think, as is the case with any state, the leaders of state government take a much more pragmatic approach to taxing and spending issues because they have to balance their budgets. They don't get to print money or borrow money from China. So I don't think you're going to see a huge swell of support for what Senator McConnell is saying. Now, where Republicans have some sympathy for what McConnell is saying is they don't want to see, particularly blue states that have got pension liabilities that are out of control, that have had spending that has been beyond their means for many, many years now, and that hasn't been addressed by state legislators, that this crisis is not an excuse to bail out states for long-term bad decisions and irresponsibility. And I do think that's going to be a fairly widely held Republican point of view. But when it comes to just the regular nuts and bolts of government, making sure we have enough police on the roads, enough DFACS workers, that we are able to keep our schools 5 days a week, which in 2010, 2011, we sometimes had four-day weeks for schools and shortened bus routes, et cetera. Those hard decisions are coming unless there is some sort of federal bailout. And even with a federal bailout, there's still going to be cuts.
But Mitch McConnell's own state, if I'm not mistaken, Kentucky, which has had Republican governors up until recently, also has a major pension crisis. So can Republicans credibly make the accusation that it's just those blue states, particularly as Andrew Cuomo pointed out in New York, states that give to the federal government more than they get back?
I think that all states have to make their case for the fact that they're not using federal relief emergency dollars to handle expenses that were out of control long before this crisis struck. Whether they're red states or blue states, I don't care. This is a pet issue of mine. In Georgia, we have a pension system for state employees. I hope my wife gets her 30-year pension one of these days because she'll have put in that much time. But Georgia's been much more responsible. We made those tough reforms through the years. We did one in 1996 that cut back on the level of pensions, and then we did it again during the Governor Perdue era. So we have seen the crisis forming for many years, and we took the tough political decisions to keep our system sustainable.
You know, what we don't want to do is get into this sort of Democratic state versus a Republican state. And he's right. I mean, you got states like California, New York, and others who feel that they go above and beyond with giving money to the federal government. But that's why, Dennis, you kind of posed this question earlier about the praise that you saw Governor Kemp giving President Trump. I have no way of proving this, haven't talked to anyone who confirmed this, but there's no way if you're Brian Kemp that you feel comfortable with what the president did to you. What I think he's decided to do is, okay, let's move forward. Let's go above and beyond to praise him, because at the end of the day, they're depending on the federal government, and particularly the two U.S. senators and the delegation members, to do what they've been doing, and that is try to get money to the state. But Brian is right. Listen, you got to give a lot of legislators, current department heads and former department heads and former governors as well, a lot of credit for building up our rainy day fund for moments like this. And I think that if you're Speaker Ralston or you Lieutenant Governor Duncan, you're definitely conveying to the governor's office that we got to have this very open and honest conversation about the future forecasting of state revenue.
And to wrap that point up, just real quickly from both of you, this all makes that income tax rate cut look like not such a good idea in retrospect, doesn't it?
Well, I certainly think that this rules out the chance of there being a second round of the tax cut when the General Assembly comes back into session, presumably in mid-June. But there's also the argument that you don't need to raise taxes during a recession. You don't want to take money out of people's pockets, out of employers' pockets. So yeah, I think there's an argument either way there. Certainly, we're going to need public funding, but there's going to be a lot of private sector need as well.
This is where, you know, and we talked a little bit about this before on our podcast, but this is where Brian's dear friend, now Appropriations Chairman, Senator Blake Tillery, is going to play a pivotal role in figuring out how the legislature begins this process of discussing that. And I think you're going to see that there's going to be a push to do exactly what you just said, Dennis, from the minority party, to say, hey, is this sort of tax cut or what we were talking about with the state income tax even necessary? But this is where legislators are going to really have to dig deep. And I hope that they put partisanship aside, get in a room, let's talk about priorities, let's talk about different things that you want to fund. And I think that you'll see a different tone on June 11th when we presumably are going to start back in the session.
Meanwhile, almost 400 Georgia poultry workers have tested positive for coronavirus. Now, most of that industry is concentrated in Northeast Georgia, particularly in Hall County. Brian, Governor Kemp sent Insurance Commissioner John King up that way a few days ago as we speak. This is a real serious issue because we had seen meat plants in other parts of the country have to shut down. The governor certainly doesn't want to do that. President Trump has ordered plants to stay open, and the plants themselves are taking what safety measures they can. But what's the big risk here, not only in terms of public health, but politically in keeping them open?
Well, let me just say, as a carnivore, that I am as thankful to the people working in the lines of those plants as I am to healthcare workers and other first responders who are on the front lines of fighting this pandemic. What they're doing is so important to not only to our health, but to national morale, to be able to go to the grocery store and pick up a packet of chicken or ground beef, whatever your taste may be. And I've been trying a little bit of all of them. I think that the Georgia poultry story is actually a very positive story. We've had one death, and that was somebody who had underlying health conditions. They have had a significant number, but much less than what we've seen in plants around the country, in other parts of the country. And I saw the picture in the paper this week that had the dividers between every worker, the workers wearing protective gear. So it does look like the industry has been proactive and responsible. And look, let's work with them any way we can. I'm glad to see the governor sending the insurance commissioner up there. That shows the state knows how serious this is, that we maintain those supply lines and get those foods out to the stores, to the people, and increasingly out to restaurants, which hopefully will be doing a little more business in the coming weeks as well.
I think I read somewhere that if Georgia's not the largest, I think we are one of the largest poultry plant providers in the world. I mean, I think people get, if not all, most of their chicken and poultry from Georgia. And so this is a booming industry in our state that has been robust for a long time. And I would tell you this, I do also want to applaud the governor for sending the insurance commissioner to these poultry plants or this poultry plant up in North Georgia, because it is something that is so important. And this is another proactive move by the governor. But I think what's going to be so important now is reporting back the data and sort of full transparency and what you found out, and to assure Georgians that what we're eating is safe.
The Theron Mike Giles, the head of the Georgia Poultry Federation, told our colleagues in the WABE newsroom that he believes the outbreak in the Gainesville area and Hall County is because of community spread outside of the poultry plants. And while that is certainly a factor, there's no doubt about that, when you look at the disproportionate numbers of Latino COVID-19 patients, and you take into account that many in that community work in those poultry plants, does anyone really believe that the plants are not one of the factors? How much sense does it make for him to say, oh, it's got to be outside of the plants?
Well, as you know, I've said on this podcast that one of the things that I feel that's been talked about but not being talked about enough is how this is disproportionately affecting African-Americans and Hispanics and sort of the socioeconomic issue with poor people. There is a common thread between Hall County, which, by the way, as we saw in the data this week that we were provided, that it had the highest percentage spike with the data that was provided on recent deaths and recent people being tested positive for COVID-19. Again, this is a booming industry in Gainesville, Hall County that we all depend on. Yes, it's got something to do with social distancing, but that's why I think that when we hear back from the insurance commissioner and others, they've got to really make it specifically plain about how this happened in Hall County and, more importantly, what are we doing about it going forward.
Well, Brian, the poultry industry certainly has political clout here. When we see them running to put in safety measures now, does that raise the question of conditions in the plants prior to this? And do you expect either state regulators or the state legislature to take a look and say, hey, we need to do better by those folks even when there isn't an outbreak?
Well, I do believe that the outbreak probably did happen outside of the plants. That's very believable. If you look at the living conditions there, Hall County is one-third Latino. Many of them are immigrants and low income, maybe up and coming because they're working hard and have good jobs.
Oh, sure. But my question was, isn't it all of the above? I'm not negating community spread, but just saying, aren't the plants a factor also?
I think any place where people are standing shoulder to shoulder working without protective gear early on in this pandemic probably had some spread there. Yeah, sure. I think that's true for a number of industries, a number of residential facilities. You know, we discuss it with nursing homes. And look, if we can talk about nursing homes for just a second, we discussed those a few weeks ago. I think what we didn't know at the time was many of the nursing homes had been proactive and had actively implemented reforms, cut off visitation, provided whatever PPE they could get their hands on. That was an issue for them early on. They couldn't get what they needed and they were desperately trying to find it. They were acting responsibly, but didn't have all the resources they needed. And I think that's probably true in the meatpacking industry as well. At the start of this, we didn't know exactly what we were dealing with. There was a lot of conflicting information. And oh, by the way, there's still a ton of conflicting information. I mean, you turn on Fox News at night and it's, why are we overreacting? This is not nearly as deadly as we thought. And then you pick up the paper the next day and it's, we're going to have this rampant increase in cases anytime now. And this is actually much more deadly for people under 65 than we originally thought. It's really hard to know what's going on sometime, even this far into it. So very early on, certainly, we didn't have all the precautions. And sure, there was spread. But I don't think that's nobody's fault.
But Brian, despite what you were saying that Fox News is saying, there is absolute hard data to confirm how deadly this virus is across the country and here in Georgia.
Well, there's hard data that some people have died, for certainly. I mean, a significant number of people have died. But I also think, you know, from what I hear, that it's not as deadly as we originally thought it may be.
But so, isn't that because of the very things that have been done that Fox News, some folks in Fox News, I should add, are saying, oh, you didn't really need to do those?
No, I do think that these measures we've taken to shelter in place, to socially distance ourselves, have helped to flatten the curve. I do think that some of these mitigation efforts have been successful. But even those who have gotten it, the death rate has still been fairly low. And that's not to minimize any death whatsoever, but it's still been a very low percentage of people who get it.
And all of this is happening as schools and students and parents are trying to figure out what's the next academic year going to look like. We'll get into that and more as the Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for keeping us company. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, Republican strategist Brian Robinson. Let's shift very quickly to a couple of non-COVID related, or at least non-COVID directly related, political bits of news. The Senate race involving Republican incumbent Senator Kelly Loeffler and a field of challengers from both parties took another turn this week when a couple of endorsements came for her chief Republican rival, Congressman Doug Collins, one of them from State Public Service Commissioner Bubba McDonald, a statewide figure, the other from the National Political Action Committee, GOPAC, which is familiar to a lot of GOP voters. It was launched into prominence by Newt Gingrich years ago, even though he wasn't the founder of it. He certainly turned it into a very effective political force. Brian, again, keeping in mind the usual caution about most endorsements, are these two significant?
I think any endorsement by a prominent person, somebody respected by Republicans, of Doug Collins is significant because it shows sort of a breaking of this dam. Early on in this race, you had a lot of people coming out and endorsing Kelly Loeffler. She was an establishment pick by the governor. And I think they would push back on that description, but it's a pick by the governor. The governor is the establishment. I don't care who you are, what governor you are the establishment. And so I think a lot of the political class, in a desire to keep the governor happy, to do what he wanted to do, came out for her, and it froze support for Doug Collins. People didn't want to be seen showing up on his financial disclosures and certainly didn't want to go out there and rock the boat by themselves and support this renegade candidate against the governor's pick. Now, Congressman Drew Ferguson from West Point in the 3rd District came out. He was one of the first major people. And I said on Political Breakfast that this may be the indicator of what's to come. And sure enough, you are seeing more and more folks step out. I think that will continue. I think it's really interesting. I get all these political emails, and I get all the emails from Doug Collins' campaign, all the emails from Kelly Loeffler's campaign. And the tone and frequency of the Loeffler campaign emails has increased dramatically over the last week or two. And they've gone from just being about, hey, look at all the great stuff we're doing for Georgia, all the hard work we are accomplishing on COVID-19, to direct personal attacks on Doug Collins. Now, previously, Collins's campaign was doing direct personal attacks on Kelly Loeffler because that was the only tool they had at their disposal. Kelly Loeffler had these third-party groups up on TV attacking Doug Collins, had them do the dirty work. Now, all those voices are quiet. There's no outside group up on TV right now attacking Doug Collins. And so you're seeing the campaigns on a much more level playing field than what we saw in January and February, just going at each other. You know, and I've said plenty of times this is going to be a bloodbath, a battle royale. And the outside money kind of kept it a little bit civil. Now that's gone, and it is hand-to-hand, clawing-in-the-face combat. And I think that's only going to continue. And one thing also to look at is you're beginning now to see outside groups for the first time come into Georgia with a significant amount of money to attack Kelly Loeffler. And the messages that they're going to be using against her will have to do with her stock trades. And there was a story that came out this week in Real Clear Politics, actually, that is very sympathetic to the storyline for Kelly. It is worth checking out, because I do think that a lot of the early storyline about her was not completely accurate, but I do think the damage is probably deep and wide.
Theron, on that subject, that story that Brian's referring to in Real Clear Politics came out on the same day that Bubba McDonald endorsed Doug Collins. The Loeffler campaign immediately sent out the Real Clear Politics story, along with some very detailed talking points about her stock trades and whether or not they were the result of information she got about the coronavirus. The level of detail is coming out weeks after the allegations surfaced. And Theron, I'm wondering if, as a political strategist, even though you're on the Democratic side, this is something that they should have done in detail before, and the fact that it's coming now with such detail means the whole episode has wounded her campaign, at least temporarily.
You know, the first thing I want to say, Dennis, is that I just love Bubba McDonald. I mean, every time I see him, he's at the Capitol, he's just fired up. And, you know, for our listeners, he's a well-respected public service commissioner. And by the way,
and a man with a great singing voice,
yes,
by the way.
Yes. But also, he was the first statewide constitutional officer to endorse now President Donald Trump when he was a candidate for president. And so the significance of that endorsement is a big, big boost to the Collins campaign. But to your point about Senator Loeffler, and Brian and I have talked about this, and I think, you know, we agree on a lot, but we definitely agree that this was something that if we were advising her, we would have advised her to do a long time ago. But to be fair, I think the information that you saw the campaign come out with this week, Dennis, they probably did not have as readily available to them when this first sort of came out. But the one thing I would tell you this, if you're in the Collins camp right now, you definitely got the momentum. I mean, you're up probably, you know, 21-7 going into halftime, right? But there's a third and fourth quarter to be played here. And I do think that the Loeffler campaign is definitely not where they want to be, but there's a lot of time left between now and November. But it does feel like it's a shift that's going on in the state, which Brian deserves a lot of credit for pointing out to us that that was the possibility of this. But the more transparent that the Loeffler campaign could be, the more information they can get out about these allegations, I think the better she will be to try to put this behind her.
I think the Collins people would say, to keep Theron's metaphor going, that they're up way more than 21-7 right now. I think that this is like, you know, when Florida played Georgia back in the mid-90s.
But this is my point about the 21-7, Brian. And the reason I didn't say it was 28-7,
28-3.
Yeah, 28-3. Oh, God, don't say that on this podcast. But the reason I said that, Ron, is because Senator Loeffler has got a talented, you know, running back that at any moment can, you know, break off a long one. And that's because she's got so much money at her disposal.
Yeah, I would definitely say that she's got a deep well of reserves there on the bench that she can put on the field at any time. And that does make a difference. But Theron and I both know, because we've both been through this, once something is cemented in the public's mind, it's really hard to pay your way out of it. People just tune it out. And that's the danger that they face at this juncture. The Loeffler campaign really needs a fundamental break that's really beyond their control, probably. Something that perhaps goes wrong for Doug Collins the way that the stock issue went wrong for her. I do think to some degree they are at a spot where much of this is out of their hands and they are reliant on outside forces to give them some good luck.
Real quickly, though, Theron, to continue the football analogy for a moment, on the other Senate race, the one involving incumbent Republican David Perdue, he told a group of Republican activists that Georgia's in play and that Democrats could flip the state and they really need to get going. It sounded like the old Georgia football coach Vince Dooley talking about what East Tennessee State could do to his Bulldogs right before a game. You're an Athenian. You've probably heard the old coach do that a lot. But the Democrats in that primary to challenge David Perdue are going at it in a way that they're finally starting to show a little bit of crossfire at each other. You've talked about in the Kelly Loeffler race, they need to focus on uniting, getting behind a candidate. That's not going to happen in the Perdue race, is it? And is that going to hurt the Democrats going forward?
Dennis, the unique thing about the Perdue campaign is that he surrounded himself with a lot of veteran GOP strategists and consultants. And, you know, Paul Beneke is a person who went to University of Georgia, who's a dog fan himself, to kind of continue with this sort of football analogy. And more importantly, you know, Paul understands that his with his previous work at RGA, now being back in Georgia, is that he's
got RGA is the Republican Governors Association, we should point out.
Correct. And so you definitely see Purdue sort of saying, hey, you know, these guys are going to have the money, they're going to have the resources, and they're going to be united, whoever the Democratic nominee who emerges. I will tell you what you saw with Teresa Tomlinson and John Ossoff, and Brian and I did a story about this earlier this week. You saw both of these two candidates go up on television. You know, Ossoff is sitting on a little less than $2 million on hand. So he was the first one to go up with an ad that sort of talked about his wife and how she's on the front line and talked a lot about healthcare industry and making sure that he holds them accountable. And it was a very pro-consumer message. Where Teresa Tomlinson, you saw, is an ad that came out sort of attacking Republicans. I think she mentioned President Trump. She mentioned Senate Majority Leader McConnell. And she also mentioned Brian Kemp. And so she's trying to unite the Democratic base. And I think you'll see here pretty soon that Sarah Riggs and Miko will come out and say something very similar. But the one common thread between all three of those candidates, which the AJC did an article about it this week, was that they are putting the COVID-19 crisis and the COVID-19 response sort of front and center in their campaign message. So it's only a matter of time that you're going to see them start implementing sort of a comparison and contrast between their candidacy and their opponent's candidacy, because they got a primary that's fast approaching and they've got to figure out a way to differentiate themselves. And so I do think you've seen a lot of sort of kumbaya moments with them, but that's going to go out the window here pretty soon. And I do think that you're going to see a lot of spending on different paid media ways for them to get their message out.
Teresa Tomlinson and Sarah Riggs Amico at this juncture are fighting for that second spot to get into the runoff. It does look, at least in polling as it stands today, that Ossoff has enough of a plurality that he's a safe bet on being in the runoff. So I think you're going to begin to see Tomlinson and Riggs Amico begin to take shots at each other and try to tear down the other so that they can get that other spot in the runoff. I predict that'll be coming soon. But look, they got to do it faster than soon. People are already voting. I have already filled out my ballot. I continue to get mail every day, but it's too late. I've already cast my ballot. Almost 1 million.
And you voted in the Democratic Senate primary, right?
It's all public record, Dennis. You can check it out. We've already seen 1 million absentee ballot request here in Georgia this week. It was just below that seven-figure mark. So while the number of returns is relatively low, midweek it was around 4,500 votes that had been returned. I think in the next week and a half, you're going to begin to see that number climb dramatically. Now, not all of those 1 million ballots are going to get filled out, but I would imagine that given how much time we have left, you're going to continue to see those requests trickling in. That doesn't even take into account the early voting and election day voting that's going to take place. But with so many people voting right now, a lot of the election could already be in the bag long before the traditional timeline when candidates go up on air and spend on television. You can't go up the last 3 weeks of the campaign the way you have always done in the past because the election may be over already. You may have missed your window. And so it's going to be very expensive for candidates to communicate effectively because they have to kind of start now and then build out toward Election Day, whereas in the past, you would start at Election Day and go backwards. That doesn't work in this scenario. So I think you may see people going dark, as we say, like not advertising because they're out of money the last couple of weeks, but it might not matter. The election may be over already.
Real quickly, though, Brian, two of the biggest school districts in the state, Atlanta and DeKalb, are not only having to plan all sorts of ways for different contingencies for the next academic year, but they're doing so as they're getting new school superintendents. We talked in the last podcast about some of the challenges that Atlanta's new superintendent, Lisa Herring, will face, but DeKalb is going to have a new one too, former New York City and Miami, Florida Superintendent Rudy Crewe, who also has had, during his career, some controversies, and the DeKalb board didn't seem to be entirely, every member at least, thrilled with wanting to say that was a great choice.
What a great way to start off a pandemic, a recession, slash school budgets, and uncertainty with the school board. I'm sure that's going to turn out just great. You know, look, when a new superintendent comes in, you need to have some sort of honeymoon period. It's essential to letting them get their feet under them. It's essential to building rapport with the faculty and staff and the employees and the system, and making sure that they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are the leader, that you have the power to make decisions and move forward, and everybody needs to get in line. And if there's any uncertainty about that, that really hurts the ability of a new leader to be effective. And we're going to need somebody super effective, super persuasive, when we are making really hard decisions about how we're going to cut budgets. You're going to see schools unable to hire new teachers. You're going to see bigger class sizes. Hope to God we don't have to see going to 4-day weeks again the way we have in the past, and furloughing teachers and not getting paid on that fifth day. Let's hope that doesn't happen, but I think it's very possible, because the economic indicators right now are actually much worse than they were during the Great Recession. You know, we had another 3 million plus people file for unemployment this week. That brings the total nationwide to 30 million people, numbers not seen since the Great Depression. So the repercussions are going to be swift, and we need leaders who are empowered to make tough decisions.
And Theron, in DeKalb and in other districts as well, there's even just the question of physical logistics. How do you get kids into existing spaces and try to separate them 6 feet if you have to?
You know, I was pretty impressed with the pick to go with Superintendent Crewe. And the reason why is because you get a veteran educator at the hand. And we've seen that the person who doesn't get a lot of credit for doing an outstanding role in sustaining the school district is now sort of soon to be retired, Ramona Tyson. She was the interim superintendent during the time before Michael Thurman came on as superintendent. And when he left, she stepped up and was there for the superintendent after him. And now she stepped up again for the new Superintendent Crewe. I think what the DeKalb County Schools are focusing on right now is making sure that all of the faculty, the staff, the teachers, and the parents, and more importantly, the students, feel supported through this COVID-19 process. The challenge is going to be is that same thing you saw in Atlanta, is that if I could say anything to Superintendent Crewe, I would tell him to spend an enormous amount of time cultivating a good working relationship with his board. Because what we've seen time and time again in Georgia, not always, but most times, a lot of the friction occurs when there's sort of not a good working relationship between the superintendent and the board, because the children of DeKalb County deserve this coordination. But I'm one that think that he's going to do a good job. I think he's the stable hand at the wheel. And I do think that he understands how important the board relationships are. And more importantly, he's got to make sure that coming out of this COVID-19 sort of post-COVID-19 process, that he's got a plan in place to make sure that everyone feels supported.
That's absolutely true. I mean, if we can look at the Maria Karstarfin situation with the Atlanta Public Schools, she was let go basically at the end of 2019. She's just now been replaced. And the complaints about her weren't about her job performance. I think most people would agree that the schools at least made a lot of progress and she was an effective leader. The problem she faced was personality conflicts with the board. They felt like she just didn't listen to them, that she felt like she was the boss, not them, the elected officials. And eventually that well of patience wore out, and you saw them be willing to make a move despite the fact that the metrics were moving in the right direction. And so the new superintendent, DeKalb, I agree with Theron. He's absolutely right. He's got tough decisions to make, and he's got to put the interests of the kids first. But part of putting the interests of the kids first is making sure that they don't have a bunch of drama back at the Board of Education that prevents progress.
And DeKalb is no stranger to board drama, Theron, just very quickly.
No, it's none.
Well, one thing I want to say real quick, Dennis, I think where you were going, you know, one of the things that gets overshadowed here is the role that former Governor Deal and Michael Thurman played in sort of moving forward to put a good board in place. You got to remember, it wasn't that long ago that Governor Deal had to make the hard decision to remove some members of the board in DeKalb County. And the person, again, who doesn't get a lot of credit is, of course, again, I want to continue to say Ramona Tyson, because she was there as a deputy superintendent at the time. But it was when she came on with Michael Thurman, who used politics and his political ability to say to Governor Deal, okay, give us a chance. I know we've made some tough decisions here, and you know, some things have not gone the right way. There's been some questions of unethical behavior, but give us a chance to work to get our accreditation back and move forward. And so the other thing is that Superintendent Crew's got to deal with is sort of the financial stability of the school district. You know, Dr. Green, who was his predecessor, got Stephen in trouble Green, because because he authorized or, you know, used some money to do some stuff that the board didn't think was just right. And so I would, again, think that he's beyond board relations and students and parents and everything. He's also got to make sure that he has a economic plan that's transparent to let the people know that he's going to be a fiscal conservative agent of funding in the school district. And then lastly, on the APS, you know, I definitely have to sort of push back. And, you know, we've talked about Superintendent Maria Karstarfin a lot on this podcast. Number one, she wasn't let go. They just did not renew her contract. And two, yeah, there were some dissension amongst the board members. But Brian, there would be some people on the south side of Atlanta, and particularly on the southwest and even on the west side of Atlanta, that they will have some questions about the performance of the schools. And let's not underscore that there was some pushback on sort of APS moving to a charter system as well.
And we should note here as we wrap up that WABE's broadcast license is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is a public affairs and government consultant and former national Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Gentlemen, thanks so much. All the best to you and your families.
I want to wish a happy birthday to Brian in a social distance shot.
Yeah, it's certainly been a birthday unlike any other.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale. That's T-I-N-S-D-A-L-E. Theron is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. And don't forget, you can catch WABE's newest podcast with up-to-the-minute information on the coronavirus. It's called Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam Whitehead is your host. And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us. Have a great and a safe week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.